whoops, I appointed a Californian to a board. I've got to fix that. I'm going to withdraw the nomination.
Democrats push back against a controversial board appointment by the governor. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 10th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Iditarod leaders leave White Mountain with their sights on the finish line.
You like look forward to the race all year, and then you enjoy the race, and then you get here and you're like, oh my God, I want it to end.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you're interested in serving on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council, the deadline to apply is Friday, March 21st. Email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message is sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Democrats in the Alaska Senate want Governor Sean Parnell to withdraw the name of one of his board appointees because of residency issues. The governor chose Dennis Mandel of Salinas, California, to serve on the State Assessment Review Board earlier this year. The board gets the final say on the value of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline for tax purposes, and appointees require legislative approval because it is a quasi-judicial body. During a floor speech on Monday, Senate Minority Leader Hollis French said he thinks Mandel's appointment violates Alaska statute.
It says that a person appointed to a board or commission of state government shall be and have been before the last general election a registered voter in the state. Boom. I mean, it's clear.
Mandel last lived in Alaska in 1995, and he worked for the now-defunct oil company ARCO for nearly two decades. He now operates a financial consulting firm out of Carmel, and he is registered as a California voter. French was emphatic that Mandel's residency was grounds for withdrawal.
Whoops! I appointed a Californian to a board. I've got to fix that. I'm going to withdraw the nomination.
The Senate Democratic Caucus also sent a letter to the governor on Monday asking for Mandel's removal. Parnell's choices for the State Assessment Review Board have also been criticized because his appointees have a background in the oil industry, and they come after the firing of Marty McGee. McGee was a longtime member of the assessment board who consistently advocated for a higher valuation of the pipeline, and he's accused the Parnell administration of stacking the board with oil industry veterans. In addition to Mandel, the governor also appointed Bernie Washington of Anchorage to the board. Washington has served as the chief financial officer of Alaska Public Media, the parent company of KSKA, KAKM, and the Alaska Public Radio Network, since 2010. Prior to that, he worked for ConocoPhillips. For his part, Washington thinks the State Assessment Review Board should have a diverse membership with members who have had experience with the oil industry and members who have worked outside it.
You get a better discussion because you have different points of view.
Washington also doesn't think residency should be a factor if a person is otherwise qualified. Last year, the board determined the pipeline was worth $12 billion, while the Alaska Department of Revenue put the number at $7 billion. The oil companies have argued for an even lower value. For every $1 billion the pipeline is worth, municipalities along its route collect about $20 million in property taxes. Neither Mandel nor the governor was available for comment. The Senate Finance Committee is scheduled to interview the board appointees on Thursday. A bill providing funding and support for some village public safety officers to carry firearms passed unanimously in the House this morning.
Clerk, please announce the vote.
38 yeas, 0 nays.
So on a vote of 38 yeas, 0 nays, House Bill 199 has passed the House.
Prior to the vote, HB 199's lead sponsor, Representative Bryce Edgman of Dillingham, explained its aim.
It basically removes the prohibition against the arming of VPSOs, but it also requires that any VPSO who would carry a firearm would do so only after meeting the necessary standards and training.
Edgman stressed the bill's voluntary nature, something sponsors have been keen to highlight as it's moved through different Senate and House hearings during the last few weeks. The regional corporations and boroughs that employ VPSOs are free to decline having armed officers if they choose.
I think it's also important to note that this bill is an opt-in bill in the sense that the communities and the regional Native associations that administer the program on a day-to-day basis would have to agree to permit the particular VPSO to be armed. No community would be forced to have an armed VPSO.
HB 199 and its counterpart, Senate Bill 98, are a response by legislators to combat rising violence against law enforcement across the state, from small communities all the way to Anchorage. The Senate version of the bill goes before the Senate, the Finance Committee on Wednesday. It's likely to pass and head to the full Senate for a vote. If signed into law by the governor, the program will have around 20 officers a year flown to the Police Academy in Sitka to undergo training. Iditarod Mushers Jeff King and Allie Zirkel are on the final stretch into Nome. King left the White Mountain checkpoint after 8 hours of mandatory rest at 3:02 this afternoon. Zirkel followed just under an hour later. Dallas Seavey will leave about 2 hours behind Zirkel, and his father Mitch will leave about 2 hours after that. KUAC's Emily Schwing caught up with King and Zirkel in White Mountain and has this story.
Jeff King was the first musher to pull into White Mountain. King's team overtook Allie Zirkel somewhere outside of Koyuk, but he says he wasn't sure if he'd managed to maintain that lead.
Because as I have done many times, I underestimated the speed of her team or what she'd get out of it, but she's only a few minutes behind me in Elam. So she must have had a great run too, because mine was really, really, really great.
As teams leave Elam, they have to tackle a few steep climbs before they drop onto a frozen lagoon where the trail's mostly glare ice this year. It's also a route notorious for high wind, so King was more than happy for the relatively calm weather.
The teeniest little gust of wind and we all just blew. Oh, if it blew for real, then nobody'd get up there.
Despite a lack of wind, Allie Zirkel was surprised by how slippery the trail was.
It's pretty interesting. I wouldn't have guessed it'd been like that, but it is.
Zirkel's lead dog, Keto, also threw her for a loop as she was leaving the checkpoint in Elam.
She chewed both of her tug lines, and I guess that one was almost chewed all the way through, and so I had him right about on the pack ice, and I'm like, ready? And she went, boom. It's just like 20 miles an hour. Meow.
Zirkel found Keto sitting in the trail waiting for the rest of the team a short while later. It's just another story to add to a long list of mushers' mishaps this year.
So funny, this part of the race. You like look forward to the race all year and then you enjoy the race and then you get here and you're like, oh my God, I want it to end.
If 58-year-old Jeff King arrives in Nome, he'll be the oldest musher to win. He'll also be the second musher to win the race 5 times. Whoever makes it to Nome first will likely set a new race record, but they'll have to find a way to fend off teams that are still gunning from behind. On the Iditarod Trail, I'm Emily Schwing in White Mountain.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a question of will the mushers have a place to stay when they get to Nome?
Nomeites seem to be downsizing. We've had several of our long-term housing hosts move out of town.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick Click Give or contributing to a college savings plan. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Alaska State Troopers say a man has been shot and killed in an incident in Wasilla. Shortly past 9 on Sunday night, a trooper and a Wasilla police officer were involved in a shooting on the Seward Meridian Parkway. Trooper reports indicated that troopers were alerted to an impaired driver and that the driver of the vehicle failed to stop at the direction of a police officer. The driver of the vehicle was shot and pronounced dead at the scene. A passenger in the vehicle was also shot and sustained non-life-threatening injuries. The trooper and police officer were not injured in the incident. There are few details available at this time, according to trooper spokesperson Beth Ibsen. Investigators from the Alaska Bureau of Investigations and Wasilla Police Department are investigating the incident. The Alaska Bureau of Investigations has assumed the responsibility of lead investigating agency. Sarah Palin fired up thousands of conservative activists who came to hear her give the closing speech of the Conservative Political Action Conference outside Washington, D.C. this weekend. Palin hasn't held elected office since she resigned as Alaska governor in 2009. But as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, at this gathering of 11,000, she was an A-list star.
The wind-up to Palin's speech included a video montage of her greatest hits and tributes and an introduction by NRA Chief Chris Cox.
Does anybody here love Sarah Palin? Now, if I walked out there and asked 100 of you why you love Sarah, I'd probably get 100 different answers.
He barely mentioned her stint as governor of Alaska. Even her run for the vice presidency, which first put her on the national stage, is not her claim to fame now. Instead, her introduction focused on her superstar clout, her ability to raise the profile of far-right candidates like Ted Cruz, who says he owes his seat in the U.S. Senate to her. Her celebrity, and how she uses it, is itself celebrated. For 45 minutes, Palin slammed President Obama and all he stands for, as well as mainstream Republican members of Congress who she says ran from the fight. The crowd rose to its feet over and over. Way in the back, one hand waved a tri-corner hat in approval. William Temple of Brunswick, Georgia, came dressed head to toe as a soldier from the Revolutionary War.
I love Sarah Palin.
Outside the ballroom, Temple spoke of an ulterior motive for coming to the gathering. He wants Palin to sign the Don't Tread on Me flag he carried into the convention center on an 8-foot flagpole. He's been trying for years.
They spirit her away. Every time I get close, they secret her out of the room, and I understand that. I need her. I desperately need her signature on my Tea Party flag.
Chelsea Reel, a student from Grand Rapids, Michigan, says she appreciates Palin's frankness, her lack of filter.
I think she definitely has more passion than other people and doesn't really hold back on her opinion. And I think that's part of the reason why some people do look down upon her, but why so many other people really enjoy her as well.
But Palin's speech left Anna Chapman of Columbia, South Carolina, skeptical. Chapman says it was funny in a late-night comedy kind of way.
I don't think she made a whole lot of sense, though. I'm going to be honest. I'm not a pet. I love her. I think she's a good role model, a good face for the Republican Party. But I just think she sounded a little too kooky. I don't know.
Judging by the crowd reaction, it seems hers was a minority view. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Fury, Alaska has submitted an operations plan for a new offshore drilling platform in Cook Inlet. As KDLL's Shaylin Cochran reports, if the project is approved, natural gas production could begin as soon as this fall.
This is a big project for Fury. They were one of the first companies on the scene at the beginning of the so-called Cook Inlet Renaissance in 2010 and brought in the jack-up rig Spartan 151 the next year to drill in the kitchen lights unit. That's the same part of the inlet where they hope to plant a new drilling platform about 10 miles north of Boulder Point. The platform would be the 17th operating in Cook Inlet, the oldest of which date back to the mid-1960s. And that was a topic of concern last fall when industry executives and state officials got together in Anchorage for a work session on what to do with some of the oldest platforms and how regulations might change for projects like Fury's. Mike Munger is the executive director for the Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council, or CIRCAC. He said at the time that the council had been sitting on a white paper with recommendations for those aging platforms since 2005, but things have changed since then.
There's so many dynamics that's happening in Cook Inlet with the new independent Hill Corps coming in and acquiring these legacy assets. And so what we were looking at, possibility of the Cook Inlet oil field 5 years ago to what it is now, it's a completely different dynamic. And so where that all shakes out as far as dismantlement, removal, and restoration, and the ultimate fate of these platforms is really up in the air right now.
No real firm action has been taken since those meetings, and what will happen with this platform when its service life is over isn't known. The plan simply states that because the design life of the platform is more than 20 years, abandonment options and technology are likely to evolve during that time, and so no exact plans for removal are being made. Last fall, State Senator Peter Michicki said those plans should be in place from the start.
I think for future development, those are agreements that should be made at the beginning. We should understand ultimately who's going to be responsible and what those expectations are. And I think that's the goal of the department. I think it's an honorable goal.
There are two phases to this operation. In the first, the platform goes up. Two 16-mile-long, 10-inch diameter subsea pipelines will be laid in, leading to a new production facility set to be built in Nikiski. Phase 2 includes keeping all the stuff in Phase 1 up and running, and also calls for intermittent use of jackup rigs as more wells are tested and developed. So far, three exploratory wells have been drilled along with one development well. The State Department of Natural Resources is taking comments on this plan until March 28th. Reporting in Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
The Alaska Department of Health is looking into possible coal ash health impacts from Aurora Energy's downtown Fairbanks plant. Coal ash is increasingly coming under scrutiny around the country due to contamination from large-scale spills. But as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the situation in Fairbanks is different.
At issue in downtown Fairbanks is coal dust and ash gradually released into the environment, mostly by air, from the Aurora Energy plant. State Environmental Health Program Manager Ali Hamadi is leading analysis of potential effects of ash-borne toxins, including dioxins, metals, and hydrocarbons.
Examine those and estimate what people may be exposed to in the short term and the long term, and based on that, assess the possible health risks that these people could be subject to.
Samples were collected from surfaces as well as soil, water, and air by an Environmental Protection Agency contractor over 2 years. An EPA summary report issued last fall shows toxics similar to those found in coal and ash at the Aurora Energy plant, but the EPA determined there was no immediate threat. Superfund site assessment manager Brandon Perkins stops well short of sounding any alarms.
At this time, we don't know if there's anything that needs to be done, but we're engaged in trying to get this assessed and figured out.
The state expects to issue a health impact report by the end of March. The investigation was triggered by a petition from Fairbanks resident Teresa DeLima, whose parents died after being beset by multiple illnesses after moving to a home across the street from the power plant in 2000.
I totally believe that my parents were poster children for the diseases caused by chronic long-term exposure to coal-fired power plant emissions and fugitive dust. I mean, we're talking rheumatoid arthritis, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, cancer.
DeLima says dust regularly tracked into the house on snowy boots and blew in through window screens in the summer.
I'm seeing this black stuff in the house.
DeLima says her fears are shared by neighbors and backed up by information from various groups, including Alaska Community Action on Toxics, which issued a report on coal ash in 2011. The report warns of heavy metal concentrations above background levels, and ACAT Executive Director Pam Miller says the EPA collected data confirms the problem specific to the Aurora Energy neighborhood.
Residences in the study area are definitely affected by coal ash fallout. I think the report is very conclusive about that. And the report also found significant concentrations of heavy metals, with at least one of these metals being detected at significant levels with respect to background at each of the residents that were tested.
Pointing to a lack of consistency in the data, Aurora Energy President Bucky Wright questions drawing conclusions from the sampling results.
Some of them would have a particular element that was elevated above background, but the one right next door would have not even a trace of it. And then one over here would have a different element that's above the background, and one over here would have a different. So when we looked at it, we can't find any consistency that says, well, element A seems to be high everywhere.
Wright says the existence of coal ash and toxins in it is different from any threat posed by them, something regulators have so far been clear about.
We haven't found anything in their report that shows that there's any element or metal or substance that is above a level that the EPA says is of concern, or any level above what the DEC says is of concern.
Coal ash is used as fill around Fairbanks, and Wright says Aurora Energy is experimenting with projects to reduce its escape at the plant by mixing it with water and during transport by using enclosed dump trucks. Coal ash is currently regulated by the state as an inert material that leaches zero to minimally into water. A federal court ruling last fall ordered the EPA to develop regulations for its disposal. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. March is Brain Injury Awareness Month. Over 800 Alaskans are diagnosed with serious brain injuries each year. 150 will die from their injuries. A variety of activities such as snow machining, riding ATVs, and playing sports carry risks of brain injury or concussion. Prevention, diagnosis, and treatment are important. Safety is a way of life. Think ahead. Protect your brain. Learn more at alaskabraininjury.net. This message brought to you by the Alaska Brain Injury Network.
A new effort to help a once healthy population of eiders is using unique methods to try to turn sparse numbers around. Stellar's eiders used to be common on parts of the YK Delta coast decades ago. Due to some combination of lead poisoning, predators, and changes of habitat, they all but disappeared and were listed as threatened under the Federal Endangered Species Act in 1997. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
Since 1970, only 11 nests have been reported on the YK Delta. As part of the long recovery plan, biologists are taking the early steps of bringing the birds back.
We want to start establishing a population of females that would return year after year to produce young.
Kate Martin is the eider recovery coordinator with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Bringing back a population is no simple task. Managers are proposing starting with captively bred birds from the Alaska Sea Life Center. They would then have to learn how to be wild birds.
One way to do that we think may be the most effective, is to actually capture wild hens on the molting grounds, hold them over winter, and then bond them with ducklings that are captively bred, and release them as a family group on the YK Delta. So that wild hen can teach those ducklings what it is that they need to know, you know, to be a successful bird, migrate to appropriate molting areas and appropriate wintering areas.
There are many unknowns with a reintroduction like this. Biologists don't fully understand how birds determine where to nest. Stellar's eiders from the Russian Arctic intermingle with Alaska-bound birds during the winter months when they go live in areas along the Alaska Peninsula stretching towards Kodiak.
You know, one of our uncertainties is how many birds that we release on the YK Delta will actually return to the YK Delta to breed. It's something we don't know until we try. And that's also because we don't know how apt one female is to return to an area from which she was born.
A meeting in Bethel will be at the Yukon Delta National Wildlife Refuge headquarters from 4 to 7 on March 6th. Managers also want to go to villages on the central coast area
that are closer to the areas where we actually would be releasing the birds, to talk with them and get their input on everything from, you know, the proposed action to the potential release sites or any input that they'd like to give us.
The planning for all this will take a long time. The agency says that preparation and development of methods will span 3 to 5 years.
It's something that we are committed to trying over several years, because it will take that long. This bird is a long-lived bird. We don't even expect to see returns of birds that we release for up to 2 years after we release them. It's just long-term, big. While it's exciting, there's just a lot of pieces to it, I guess.
A link to information about the proposed reintroduction and how to comment will be posted at kyuk.org. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Iditarod teams are expected in Nome tonight, and some mushers still do not have a place to sleep once they get there. KNOM's Anna Rose MacArthur reports from Nome.
Mushers have long depended on Nome residents to provide them a place to rest after the almost 1,000-mile journey. However, over the last 5 years, it's become more difficult to find hosts to house mushers. Deborah Menendez is the Iditarod Nome Housing Coordinator.
Nomites seem to be downsizing.
We've had several of our long-term housing hosts move out of town, and the economy as a whole. We also have a lot of temporary housing being taken up by some of the new enterprises in Nome.
Menendez says about 10% of mushers book hotel rooms and a few rent houses, but those are usually veteran racers with large sponsors. The rest of the competitors depend on host families. While many Nome residents are willing to open their homes, some charge up to $150 a night per person for floor space. But Menendez only coordinates with hosts offering free housing.
It's extremely expensive just to get to the start of the race, especially the rookies.
And the rookies are the mushers hit hardest by the housing crunch. While veterans have established a reputation and relationships in town, some staying with the same host family for decades, rookies are unknowns without a foothold in the community. And this year, even veterans are having a hard time finding a place to stay. Five veterans and four rookies still do not have a room to sleep in once they arrive. Menendez says Nome has never failed to house a musher. Once the first teams cross the finish line, people get excited, word of mouth spreads, and the housing shortage closes. But this year, mushers are approaching faster than ever before, complicating the problem.
It's been a fast trail, so whereas we would expect a lot of the mushers typically to come in later in the week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, those mushers may be coming in sooner, and that's the issue that we're seeing this year.
Hosting a musher, Menendez says, comes with perks, like hearing race details and stories from the trail, as well as forming relationships spanning the state, the country, and the world. Menendez says families and individuals who open their homes often show great hospitality to mushers, providing home-cooked meals and transportation. Despite the current housing deficit, Menendez remains optimistic that every musher will have a place to stay this year. Reporting in Nome, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes and Anna Rose MacArthur in Nome, Emily Schwing on the Iditarod Trail, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ben Matheson in Bethel. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The University of Alaska Southeast offers degree programs you won't find anywhere else, like the customizable BLA. Online or on campus, information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
Subsistence is a significant part of the lives of many Alaskans. If it's important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide information and recommendations to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. The deadline to apply is Friday, March 21st. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.